A protest in Rapid City leads to several arrests. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Ariel Zients has the story of a land back protest that led to trespassing charges. We talk with macroeconomist Joe Santos about central bank digital currency. We'll explain what that means and how it impacts you. We take a moment for South Dakota history with a look at the Sioux Falls Army Radio Training Station back in World War II. Kevin Wooster is with us. Talk about taking off the mask and then putting it back on. And later in the hour, the Chamber Festival of the Black Hills will have a preview of that. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
And with SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. A Los Angeles-based photographer is visiting all 50 states to document the stories of LGBTQ young people. Two recent events added South Dakota to that list. SDPB's Megan Feary has more.
About a dozen teenagers and young adults gathered in Rapid City last week for an LGBTQ-friendly event at the Cave Collective. It's a youth-oriented community center. Some of those who attended say they don't feel safe living in South Dakota. Trixie Murphy lives in Box Elder.
It gets to a point of where you can't even, like, openly tell people that you're dating someone of the same sex without being scared of what they're going to do.
Murphy wasn't sure what to expect from the event, but an evening of food, games, and arts and crafts brought strangers together and created new friendships. There was also an event in Sioux Falls. The Transformation Project and Project Contrast sponsored the gatherings. They are nonprofits that advocate for transgender youth by amplifying LGBTQ voices through storytelling. Maxwell Poth is the founder of Project Contrast. He's traveling the country taking pictures of everyone who attends the events.
I wanted to create a photo project with relatable stories. A lot of kids don't plan to become YouTube sensation or move to New York City and like run a giant nonprofit. They just want to like survive and live another day. We understand that it gets better, but what can you do until it gets better?
Poth grew up in Utah in a Mormon family. He came out when he was 15. His family supported him and they eventually left the church. But Poth says he still struggled. He was bullied and thought of suicide. When a boy from his hometown took his own life after coming out, Poth says he wanted to help others.
We want to show them that they have community right where they are, so they don't have to run away.
Poth focuses on areas of the country that lack LGBTQ representation. His stories and photographs are online and will eventually become a book. So far, Poth has held events in 27 states. He plans to visit another 15 this year. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Megan Feary.
A new monthly survey of business leaders suggests the economy continues growing at a strong pace in 9 Midwest and Plains states. The overall index for the region crept up to 73.5 in June from May's already strong 72.3 reading. Any score above 50 suggests growth. Creighton University economist Ernie Goss said the region is expected to keep growing and return to pre-pandemic levels early next year. Business leaders said supply delays are causing problems in manufacturing and high inflation remains a concern. The monthly survey covers Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, and South Dakota. And in today's weather, we have a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the west, with showers and thunderstorms likely before the afternoon in the northeast. A chance of showers and thunderstorms after 3 p.m. in the southeast. Going into tonight, we can expect rainy conditions to persist in the evening in the west and the southeast. Partly cloudy skies in the northeast. We're expecting highs in the 70s and 80s across the state, with lows in the 50s and 60s. Looking at tomorrow, we have mostly sunny skies in the west and northeast, with mostly cloudy and gradually getting sunnier skies in the southeast. For listener support at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Farmers Business Network released the 2021 acreage report ahead of the USDA's acreage report for June. Kevin McNew is chief economist with Farmers Business Network, and he's joining us now with insight into what these reports mean for South Dakota producers. Kevin, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about how the Business Network's report and survey of members intersects with the USDA's acreage report. Help us understand the connection.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have over 25,000 farmers across the globe, mostly centered in U.S. and Canadian areas. Every kind of key report, we try to poll our farmers and say, what did they plant? What do they intend to plant? Going into this June report, our farmers told us pretty clearly that they weren't planting as many corn and bean acres as what the overall trade thought. And that turned out to be right on June 30th when the USDA released their official estimates. So, the overall message was there was a lot of profitable crops out there, winter wheat being one of them. And that really kind of kept corn and beans out of farmer rotations as much as the markets had thought. And so we saw markets eclipse sharply after that report. But here we are after the July 4th holiday. And we've got some rains in the forecast that are bringing markets down. So unfortunately, farmers always face a lot of volatility in this time of year in particular.
All right, let's break it down and start with corn.
Yeah, with corn, we had, what's been a pretty split personality growing season. Farmers did increase their corn acres versus what they thought was going to be planted in March. Because prices did run up pretty good between kind of March and the tail end of planting. So we did see more corn acres. But we've had really, really challenging growing conditions. South Dakota kind of being at the epicenter, North Dakota, Minnesota, just really struggling with this heat and dry situation. A little bit of a reprieve here, as your weather talked about just before this spot. But as we look into July and August, it looks like heat and drought will be persistent through much of the northern plains.
All right. Soybeans.
With beans, farmers just, weren't as eager to plant beans as what the market thought. And so, the bean numbers that that USDA reported in March is pretty much what they stuck with in June. And I think the bean situation looks pretty tight as we go into the growing season. And again, if the weather doesn't cooperate, especially in August when beans need moisture, the bean situation could be exceptionally tight. And I think the market potential for prices to rally looks pretty promising.
Tell me the situation in China and just how some of that international trade plays into beans.
Yeah, I mean, it's so vital, Lori, that, beans are just, we're so reliant on China. And obviously, we felt the effects of that a couple of years ago with the trade war, and we've got that behind us. But we have competition. We have competition from South America. The good news is China is needing and will continue to need a massive amount of soybeans, not just from the Brazilian farmers, but also from U.S. farmers to meet their needs. So I think that's a really strong story going forward. But China, I think what's been interesting in the last 6 months is what they really need in the corn situation. They need a lot of corn that we hadn't really thought about or hadn't really seen historically.
What's driving that?
Well, it's a couple of things. One, they changed their corn policy about a decade ago where they stopped subsidizing corn production. And as a result, they kind of ate away at some of these large inventories of corn they had. And unfortunately, we don't really know how much corn is in their grain bins. And so that's kind of been a mystery. And so I think what we realized this growing season was that, China kind of ran out of corn. And so they needed to turn to the world market in fairly sizable volumes at a time in the last year when we've had some crop production problems in the U.S. last season and then in South America this season. So it's kind of led to the perfect storm of events to get prices up to really, really strong levels for farmers across the country.
I want to go back to spring wheat because it seems like the drought would be impacting that. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that is really a dire situation. Up here where I am in Montana, we're clearly in the midst of a really severe drought. The crops just really looks bad. Conditions are really bad. We're expecting pretty sizable yield losses across a wide swath of the spring wheat country in the U.S. Northern Plains as well as into the southern Canadian prairies. So I think that's a really interesting market story, because we have plenty of other kinds of wheat, like hard red winter wheat grown in the southern plains, but we are going to run very, very short of the high-protein spring wheat varieties grown up here in the northern part of the country. So I think there's going to be a really strong premium for that high-protein wheat that our North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana farmers grow.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the international demand and how other countries are playing into that, particularly, you know, we mentioned China, we mentioned South America. How about Europe or the Russia-Ukraine area?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a lot of different players involved in agriculture these days. I mean, you mentioned Russia, and when we talk about wheat, we really have to think about Russia because they're such a dominant force. Their crop is looking pretty good. It's always a little dicey as we get to the later half of the year, but so far, the early part of their growing season has been strong in terms of moisture. No real severe crop problems noted there. Europe, similar type of thing where, you know, there's some areas that are a little drier than normal, but overall, no real hiccups. So right now, I think as we look, globally, especially as it comes to wheat, it's really the northern U.S. and the southern Canadian provinces where we just have this really, really severe drought that is firmly entrenched. And you know, will basically help spring wheat prices.
All right. And all that changes, you know, as we look to the next 30 days and every drop of rain that we hope for or are disappointed that doesn't come our way. So this is a pretty important and volatile time from a weather and climate standpoint as well. Right, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so critical right now. We're hoping these rains come. They're going to be vitally important to the crops. And the question will be, is this short term or we're going to see a kind of a return to these really hot and dry days for the balance of the growing season?
Kevin McNew is chief economist with Farmers Business Network. Kevin, thanks so much for being here with us once again.
Thank you, Lori.
Ahead on the program, weekend protests in Rapid City ended in several arrests. SDPB's Ariel Zients has the story. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Business and community development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
Sanford Underground Research Facility's Neutrino Day Star Chronicles is going virtual July 9th and 10th. In our virtual town, you can talk with scientists, engineers, and educators. Explore interactive activities, experience some weird science, take virtual tours, and visit the art gallery and library. At our finale, learn about native ways of understanding the stars with keynote speaker Annette Lee. Join the fun. Go to neutrinoday.com.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. You know, we talk a lot on this show about people's careers and how they do what they do. And whenever people flip the script on me and ask me how I do my job, I tell them that what I do on a day-to-day basis would not be possible if it were not for the support of public radio listeners. It's because of you that Marketplace is able to report on the business and economic news that affects all of our lives every single day. So thank you for supporting our program and your local public radio station. We appreciate it.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Protests in Rapid City on the 4th of July led to the arrest of several protesters. During the planned protest, a small contingent of protesters climbed Dakota Mill grain silo in downtown Rapid City and displayed an enormous United States flag, upside down, with the words "land back" and the number 1505 printed on the flag. That number appears to refer to the remains of 1,505 indigenous children
found near a Canadian government boarding school recently. SDPB's Ariel Zients was present at the time of the arrests. I spoke with her this morning from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio. Tell us about the stated purpose of the protests. What were these protesters there for on the 4th of July?
In a ways, it was a continuation of, this was nearly a year after the July 3rd protest in, near Mount Rushmore, and it was organized in part by the same group, Indian Collective. So a lot of it was focused on the land back movement, which is a movement to return land to Indigenous peoples, for example, Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills, and, you know, Indigenous rights and sovereignty issues, colonization. And then this year, there was a big focus on all the children who have been quote-unquote discovered at boarding schools, and I say in quotes because a lot of people know that they're there. It's just that they're formally being found.
All right, so I want to go back a little bit here and tell me when you first arrived, what did you see? How many protesters are we talking about?
Sure. So when I arrived once they had already done the flag drop. There was maybe about 100 people there.
Let's talk about the flag drop. So these are several protesters who climb to the top of a grain tower and drop an enormous upside-down American flag with the words land back on it. What are you referring to when you say the flag drop?
Sure. So there was a protest earlier in the day. There was a march, a protest throughout downtown Rapid City. They went to the jail. There were reports of the inmates in the jail banging on the windows, you know, in solidarity. While that's happening, four protesters climbed up the grain tower, and they did this by having a ladder that they leaned against the wall, which connected to a ladder that's on the side of the building. And they climbed hundreds of feet up, wearing harnesses and clipping in for safety. And then they dropped this enormous upside-down American flag, which of course, and it's upside down, which of course represents typically a country in distress. And in this case, they meant it to represent Indigenous people being in distress and also just calling into question, what does the flag represent for Indigenous people in this country? Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that police response, because you say the original protest, you know, part of that journey was, you know, a time for prayer and solidarity with incarcerated Indigenous people. And then these other four protesters sort of break away to climb the grain tower and display the flag. Where are the police? What is the police presence during this time? Where are they at?
Everyone eventually goes to the grain tower. The police surround the buildings with cars and then with their bodies. There may be 24 police, but there might have been more that I couldn't see because it's a large property. There was police, sheriff deputies, highway patrol troopers.
All right, so let's talk about this, you know, this other presence of rhetoric from, you know, directed at police.
Sure. So one difference I noticed between, compared to last year, this year there was definitely a more anti-police focus. People lied out some sort of sausage and it was supposed to represent pigs in a blanket. There was some more anti-police chanting and taunting, and that was also clear on the poster, which said no more cops and messages like that. And the police just kind of, they're trained to not respond when that happens.
So police officers did not respond to that kind of taunting. They did issue some arrests. How did the arrests go down and what were they for?
Sure. So the four people, this was clearly a planned act of civil disobedience. They knew what they were doing was illegal and it was meant to get attention, and it did. They stayed up there until the fireworks ended, and they climbed down, and there was legal observers there and police at the ground waiting to greet them, and a police van, which basically we saw. They had huge backpacks on from the gear they had to bring up. You kind of saw officers checking the people out, making sure they were okay, and then eventually leading them into the van. They were charged with trespassing. That's just by police. There haven't been prosecutor charges yet. They were just released from jail and without a monetary bond.
I spoke with SDPB's Ariel Zients this morning. You can find her full coverage of the protests on our website at sdpb.org/news. Well, how do large-scale economic forces work on our lives? Joe Santos joins us for Monday Macro. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
To Tuesday evening on Jazz Nightly, we've got new music from guitarist Dan Wilson. He's playing shows the influences of guitar greats Wes Montgomery, Grant Green, and George Benson. From Canada, we'll hear the Cold Quartet, a group inspired by Ornette Coleman. We've also got a live performance from drummer Dave Buckle, plus classic tracks by alto saxophonist Paul Desmond and pianist Bill Evans. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
Stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding by Midco Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midco.com/business.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Central bank digital currency is being called the central bank's answer to cryptocurrency. On today's Morning Macro, we're going to try to understand exactly what it is and why it's significant. Joe Santos is professor of economics and Dykehouse Scholar of Money, Banking, and Regulation at South Dakota State University. And he's joining us today from the Janine Basinger Studio on the campus of SDSU. Joe, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. Thanks to have me.
All right. This is super fascinating and nerdy stuff, but I want to start with the question, why should people care? Can you explain to me how some of these big forces, like the central bank digital currency, are impacting our lives? Or is it just an exercise in kind of understanding inside baseball?
No, it's a good question. This has some real practical implications. So a central bank digital currency, or CBDC for short, and believe it or not, everybody refers to it as that. It is a form of money. I should start by saying it is a conceptualization. So before anybody thinks they're actually using this, they're not. It is not broadly available in practice. But the idea here is that it would be a form of money that would be a direct claim on the central bank. So we do this already. Think a $20 bill. That's a Federal Reserve note. It's a direct claim on the central bank, and it's money. And just for a moment here, compare that thought of a $20 bill to a checking account balance, also money, also in digital form, that is worth $20. So that distinction there is the one to keep in mind. The $20 bill is now digitized and it becomes central bank digital currency. So it is more like a $20 bill or a note than it is a checking account balance. Again, the CBDC is a direct claim on the central bank. A checking account balance is a direct claim on a bank. So there's a fundamental difference there. As for daily lives, if central bank digital currency were to catch on, we would likely be using that certainly in lieu of a Federal Reserve note, paper, a $20 bill. But, and this is an interesting implication of all this, we could imagine a world where we just begin using it in place of checking account and savings account balances as well. And we can talk more about that. But that has broad implications for the banking system, which of course uses checking accounts and savings accounts as a source of funding. So again, as far as the practical implications, sure, we could be buying cups of coffee with CBDC instead of paper money, so to speak, and certainly instead of drawing on checking account balances.
Okay, so for people who think they're already doing this, you've explained the difference. Like, no, you're not.
Not yet, you're not.
That's right. So what we're doing is we are exchanging. When we are talking about an electronic exchange of some sort, we're exchanging claims to what we think of in very nerdy ways as intermediated liabilities, checking accounts, savings accounts, and we're moving back and forth between those. Again, those are claims on banks, which incidentally have claims on the Federal Reserve directly. They're called bank reserves. But that is not central bank digital currency.
Okay, so do you need a bank then?
Yeah, so this is the question, right? So as it is now, currency, just old school paper currency, is in many ways a substitute for checking account balances, but the currency is not digital. It's not electronically transferable. So, you know, right now, deposits may be something we favor over currency for most of our daily transactions. But if the currency becomes digital, and I should say, as a practical matter, we're thinking about this in a way that can still be cleared, settled, and so on. So the digital currency really is less of a picture of your dog on your phone and more of an account, but it's an account with the central bank. Let that just sink in for a second. So everybody who holds central bank digital currency necessarily has a bank account with the Federal Reserve. So now to your good question, why would you bank at a bank if you could bank at the central bank, right? And so the concern here is that would be viewed by most of us as a preferred form of money, that is the central bank digital currency, certainly during a crisis. So just as we used to run for the exits and draw currency out of the bank in an old school bank run, now we can do it at the speed of light, let's say, and just move it from a checking account to central bank digital currency. So demand deposits, as we call them, checking accounts, savings accounts, and so on, could be a real flight risk for commercial banks, certainly in tough times. But you can also imagine a situation, even in good times, where we look at the two options and think, well, I'll just leave it as CBDC, even in good times. And that, of course, changes the funding model dramatically for banks.
So when we talked before, we talked about Bitcoin and Dogecoin and the undermining of the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. Are we concerned about that with this CBDC, central bank digital currency?
Yeah, well, from the central bank's perspective, there are two, I think, interrelated reasons, at least, why they're pioneering this sort of thing. One is that currency, again, just think paper dollars, we are holding far less of it relative to bank deposits now. And in some places, this is really stark. So Sweden is sort of the example where something like $4 of currency is held for every $100 of checking account balances. So if that, if you will, in modern crypto parlance, if that token, that Federal Reserve note, were to disappear, you know, central banks are concerned that their monetary sovereignty, if you will, would perhaps be jeopardized. So that's one issue. And then the other, of course, and it's interrelated, is that, well, then on top of this, if you have this sort of perfect storm of alternative private monies, if that's what we want to think of Bitcoin as, then perhaps those cryptocurrencies, if you will, would suddenly predominate. So the central bank is viewing this, if anything, as a way to preserve its presence in the payment system now that everything is, one, going digital, but then, two, we've got all of these, well, some view them as candidate currencies out there, private issued blockchain platforms and so on. So I think if the central bank were to answer this great question you just asked, they'd say, no, no, CBDC doesn't threaten our existence. It preserves it.
Let's go back to the beginning of this conversation. When we talk about why we care about these sort of things, you know, one, it's kind of fun to understand. Again, for listeners, it's, you know, it's conceptualized right now. This is sort of, a lot of it's rhetorical. But people are asking, well, how does that affect me? I'm not digitized. How does it affect people who can't access? Is this another way for wealthy people to get wealthier and to move money in bigger, bolder ways? But yet the you know, average worker is kind of further left out of this digital economy.
Yeah, there is this interesting issue of inclusion around all of this because, you know, the proponents argue that, well, if we design this right, we can make this more of a sort of inclusive digitized money, because currently there are those who are so-called unbanked or underbanked. And so to the extent that the other form of money, bank liabilities, we call checking and savings accounts, to the extent that that form of money is digitized, then if you're unbanked, you don't have access to the electronic clearing and settling payment system. So there is this argument that, look, if we sort of do this from scratch correctly, we could ensure inclusion in ways that perhaps we don't have now. Of course, there is this other view of all of this that says if you haven't managed to establish sufficient inclusion with old school checking account and savings account balances, if someone is unbanked now, are they likely to essentially open up an account with the central bank? If you tended to resist your local community bank lobby, are you really going to engage directly with the central bank and establish central bank digital currency accounts? So this is a really an open question, and I can tell you a lot of the self-study, and the Federal Reserve promises to release a white paper soon on its own self-study of what they think they should do going forward. Inclusion comes up an awful lot. You know, can we sort of fill that void that is currently there, the unbanked within the traditional banking system, or does this just sort of look the same way in that regard?
Interesting, because this is about access too. It's not just about people who have felt disinclined to develop a relationship with a bank. It's about being able to get to one, be able to get to the technology that you need to access all kinds of things now. The gap is widening, isn't it?
Exactly. So to the extent that this just sort of reinforces that barrier to entry, you know, in cases of Sweden where they're, merchants are requesting that customers do not pay with, you know, traditional currency and just do this electronically. But you can imagine that being a significant barrier to entry to someone who is just not as digitally inclined and, you know, all sorts of social reasons for that and so on, but they're not as digitally inclined, then you know, they can't buy the soft drink at the counter at that moment, right. And so they are very much not included. So there is this tension that you're rightly picking up on when we talk about central bank digital currency as another form of perhaps exclusive digitized money, if that's in fact what it is.
And Joe, I was talking to some folks over the weekend who, you know, were somewhere at a local retail outlet and the sign was still up about, you know, cash shortages and coin shortages. And the question was, wait, are we still experiencing that kind of shortage? People want to also be able to opt out of some of this digital economy, and they want to be able to use things like cash for different purposes. Are we moving further and further conceptually away from the existence of, you know, giving your nephew a $20 bill for her birthday or his birthday, their birthday, and then them going and buying some candy with it? Like, how far are we pushing away from that, and do we have the choice to opt out of some of that digital monetization push?
Really good question, and I'm not going to trivialize it with this quip, but I will say, you know, in conceptual sense, I suppose you can tap your phone to your nephew's phone and somehow, you know, still give them a 20. But I totally get the question. Is this going to have a sort of unintended effect by eliminating, you know, traditional currency in circulation? I will say my understanding is it's not any central bank's intention to eliminate it, but this goes back to our sort of fundamental discussions of money.
Yeah,
after all,
right,
the way we define it is it's a generally accepted means of payment. So even if the central bank says, look, we're going to leave all the Federal Reserve notes out there, you hand each other 20s all you want, if that merchant says it's no longer generally accepted here, that can get a bit tricky as a practical matter as to what extent does currency fall out of circulation because it's not as generally accepted as it once was. So it's a really good question. This could sort of accelerate what appears to be in some countries already an extinction of old school, currency in circulation.
Yeah.
And I know that's not where you're going in this school.blog
post.
But I think it's fascinating because there was, you know, you have this push for merchants. You know, we have how many small business owners in the state trying to make decisions about, you know, things like whether or not to accept checks. And, you know, slowly but surely it becomes almost absurd to expect that your check will be accepted at what, and then the pandemic hits and all of a sudden half of them are not taking cash or really encouraging you not to bring cash in. And people are starting to ask, are we being locked out of something that we don't have a choice about because everything is working in the advantage of the business owners in the digital economy? And when do we get to choose? I think that's a big, juicy question.
It is. You know, it's, as you started this discussion off by saying, how does this apply to our lives? It clearly very much does. This is a very sort of personal issue for all of us, how we engage in monetary exchange. You wouldn't think it is, but it is. And yeah, central bank digital currency, were it to materialize, would certainly, at the very least, alter monetary exchange for most of us, I suspect, rather quickly. And again, there is this issue we discussed with traditional banking as well. I mean, banks solve all sorts of interesting problems in the credit space, and a lot of folks are dependent on banks for that other role, not opening accounts, but borrowing money. And if banks are defunded in ways that we could imagine they might be with an alternative like central bank digital currency, that's another big issue in terms of inclusion. Certain rungs of society, if you will, are heavily dependent on credit afforded by the banking system. Most of us can't just put our name on a bond or a stock and sell it in an IPO. We require intermediated credit.
So interesting, and I think we'll talk more about this in the future, but as we see survey data talking about how anxious people are about the economy, I'm guessing, I'm speculating, but just being able to understand it is probably part of what's driving the anxiety. And that's why Joe Santos is here. He's professor of economics and a Dyckhaus Scholar of Money, Banking, and Regulation at SDSU. You can find his blog and all its editions at schooled.blog.com. And then we always put up a link on our website as well at sdpb.org/news. Joe Santos, thank you.
Thank you, Laurie.
Let's take a moment now for South Dakota history. On this day in 1942, the first group of service members began arriving at the Army Radio Technical Training School, established in Sioux Falls as part of the 2nd Technical Training District. The 2nd District encompassed training schools at 7 air bases throughout the Midwest in support of the Army Air Corps during World War II. Each training school specialized in one aspect of technical support, ranging from aircraft and engine mechanics to radio operations and maintenance. The training facility at Sioux Falls Army Airfield offered classes day and night focused on radio maintenance and communications. The school trained radio operator mechanics, or ROMs, in electrical and radio fundamentals and in Morse code. 161 classes of up to 450 trainees each passed through this facility, including some 300 African Americans of the 85th Aviation Squadron, who were segregated on the base and in town. There were also members of the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps, or WAC. Sioux Falls was a microcosm of wartime mobility and integration. Each new recruit received a handbook containing information about the technical school, Sioux Falls Army Airfield, the city, and its many services for the school personnel. It included telephone service information and rates for soldiers phoning home. It also included a map of Sioux Falls and city information, including church services, parks and recreation opportunities, and service clubs that provided meals and support for military personnel. At its peak, there were 27,000 soldiers stationed at the base, with nearly 50,000 passing through the base during the war. The school closed in May 1945, and the base was deactivated later in the year. Later renamed Joe Foss Field and Sioux Falls Regional Airport, the facility remains the home for the 114th Fighter Wing of the South Dakota Air National Guard. But on this day, 81 years ago, service members began arriving at the Army Radio Technical Training School, established in Sioux Falls. Production help for this day in South Dakota history comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, professor of history at Presentation College. Ahead on the program, Kevin Wooster talks about taking off his mask and then putting it back on. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News weekday afternoons. This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The Delta variant of the coronavirus has been detected in South Dakota. The South Dakota Department of Health is urging unvaccinated people to get their COVID vaccines. 57% of South Dakotans have received at least one dose of the shot. Just over 52% have received the full series. You know the story. The pandemic isn't over. Well, how is our vaccine rate changing our behavior as we navigate summer? Is it changing our behavior? Kevin Wooster tackles the topic on his blog. You can find his work on our website at sdpb.org/Wooster. In his most recent post, he writes about bumping into his friend Sam Hurst at the grocery store, both men unmasked, and wondering if that's the best idea for public health.
Well, I'm in a mask quandary these days, you know, because I'm fully vaccinated and the CDC guidelines are at this point that if you are, you can kind of move around quite a bit without a mask now and feel pretty secure. But in this, I'm still uncomfortable. So sometimes I wear a mask and sometimes I don't. If I'm in a hurry, I just happen to stop at the grocery store. And went in. Hardly anybody anymore now has masks on. A lot of younger people, some of whom, you know, who knows if they're vaccinated or not. And as I was coming up to the checkout, the self-check, where all kinds of problems arise because you cram in there, you know, with a whole bunch of other people. Well, I get very nervous there. Not as nervous now as I used to, but the only one there was my buddy Sam Hurst, and he was checking out without a mask. And Sam was about my age, almost exactly. And so I said, "Where's your mask?" And he said, he shrugged and said, "It's over." And he, of course, was joking because it's far from over, the pandemic. But here were the two of us, two of the most careful people that I know in the last year, both 170, one very close to 70. And we both stand there without masks. And what a different world that is. And we kind of joked around, and as I went out, I thought about that, and I thought what sticks in my mind are percentages, you know, and the safety percentages of whether it's the old alpha strain or whichever strain of COVID. My Pfizer two vaccine shots are supposed to take me to, 90%? Somewhere in there of protection from contracting it, and somewhere in there, or maybe a little higher, from ending up with a hospitalization illness.
Right,
and that's great, but that still leaves a percentage to worry. So that's kind of what the column was about, and part of the reason I called Monument Health.
All right. So you talked to Dr. Shankar Kura, who has been relentless about sharing health information throughout this pandemic. What did you want to know from him?
Well, I called Dan Daly, you know, a former mm-hmm. colleague at the Journal that's now out there, and asked him, what's the story? What are people talking about? Well, Dan said it's not as big a story now as it used to be, obviously, but there's still a lot of concern out here. And Dr. Kern would be very happy to talk because he's very open and a very great interview about his concern about this, the sagging numbers of people getting the vaccination and the new variant, the Delta. And so those were the two things that he wanted to talk about and really, really try to encourage younger folks, younger than 70, especially to start lining up and getting those shots, because there could be trouble ahead if we don't.
Yeah, more likely to be hospitalized if you contract the Delta variant. Again, not a huge risk for vaccinated people, but a huge risk for unvaccinated people. And we've got thousands of them in South Dakota, people who have chosen not to get the vaccine for one reason or another. When do we go back to wearing masks for those people? I mean, as you look at masking for the benefit of others, how are you kind of approaching this ethical challenge of, well, I did the thing that I was supposed to do to protect myself. When do I start wearing a mask again to protect people who have chosen not to get the vaccine, even though they have access to it?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? And they are seeing, Monument is seeing, and hospitals across the country are seeing more younger people come in. And younger can be, you know, 25, 35, 45, in the 50s even. You know, we're talking about all those age groups younger than I am, and seeing more of those. And I think of myself, let's say it's a 10% chance that I could contract it. That's still a 10% chance. And mm-hmm. and for myself, I don't want to take much of a chance on being a breakthrough infection, somebody vaccinated that still gets the disease. And the very small percentage chance that I would get quite sick, I just as soon not take that chance either. And if I happen to be asymptomatic and carrying it, I'd hate to pass it on to somebody that isn't vaccinated. So what do you do now? Well, I've started carrying my mask again, and in certain situations, I pull it out, put it on, and boy, I got to tell you, now there aren't very many people wearing them besides me.
Right.
And young folks, young people that look like they would be, you know, in tune with these kind of things are wearing them, but most people not.
Mm. What about children? Are we worried about this Delta variant? And, you know, do you think about your kids, whether it's this variant or you know, other variants as more adults get vaccinated but kids can't get vaccinated, variants that will attack this unvaccinated population? What about your grandkids? You thinking about that lately?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, I don't see most of my biological grandkids, but I see my step-grandchildren regularly. It's ironic because last fall, Mary and I quarantined for 2 weeks because we were exposed to the COVID virus through grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Several of them here in Rapid City contracted it, along with a couple of adults in the family. And so we quarantined for 2 weeks. We didn't end up getting it. But now it's kind of gone the other way. Now, because obviously they've proven these kids can get it because they had it. And they got sick. They didn't get as sick as the adults did, fortunately. But they were clearly had, you know, pronounced flu-like symptoms and mm-hmm. lethargy and fever. And so you ask yourself now the kind of the shoes on the other foot in terms of concern. How do we protect the kids?
Yeah,
as you say, unvaccinated kids.
And as Sam said, it's over, shrug, because it's far from over, isn't it?
It's far from over, and Sam and I agree on that.
You can find Kevin Wooster's work online at sdpb.org/Wooster. The 14th Chamber Festival of the Black Hills begins this Friday and Saturday, and it runs for the following two weekends with three different programs with themes like Let the Sunshine In, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and Age of Aquarius. The orchestra is hoping the music will take people back to a special summer in their lives. Joining us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio and SDPB's Black Hills Studio, we have Michael Hill, Executive Director of the Chamber Festival of the Black Hills. Michael Hill, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Lori. Thank you for having me on.
So much of this year and summer programming and summer festivals is informed by the summer that was last year and the return to gathering spaces. Tell us a little bit about how you handled programming and coming together again after a year of so much separation and isolation.
Well, it was really easy. We took about 10 different options and waited to see how things were going to pan out.
Super easy. Yeah.
Yeah, super easy. Just figure out, because, you know, no one knew what was going to happen. Yeah. And things started moving in the right direction, thankfully. And my wife, Dawn Marie Edwards, is our artistic director. She really wanted to put a positive foot forward. And we've always had the mindset that great music is great music. It doesn't have to be classical. It can be pop. It can be anything. And she really wanted a positive experience for our patrons this summer and came up with the programming of Peter Schickley. Most people would know as PDQ Bach. He would write the funny classical music, but he's actually really a prolific, excellent composer. And it's this front porch style bluegrass type music, fiddle playing, and it's phenomenally fun. And she mixed it with an African-American composer named William Grant Still. It was a really neat harp piece. It would be, I guess you would call it a harp septet. So it's all of our musicians. And then
but you would call it a what?
Septet.
Septet.
A harp septet. Sorry.
That's harp septet. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, say that three times really fast. but it's going to feature all of our musicians. So a harp is the lead instrument. It has a string quintet and piano behind it. So we have seven musicians, the full complement of everybody. And then we'll end it with Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, which is something we've come across and been wanting to do for a long time. So it's a huge mixture, but it's just going to be so much fun.
And that's all part of Let the Sunshine In on July 9th and 10th. So where is this at? How do people access the concerts? Is this an inside, outdoor event?
This is an indoor event. Okay. We're at the Journey Museum. It's in the gallery. So the gallery at the Journey Museum in downtown Rapid City. It's a beautiful building. It's a nice, spacious room. We've set it so that the seating is going to be spaced out. We want everyone to really be comfortable. And we keep an eye on all the news and all the programs that you present regarding COVID and everything that's going on. And we take it very seriously. And we'll open and air everything out beforehand. We'll do a short intermission, air it out again, and let people choose. If they want to sit in groups and if they feel comfortable, that's great. Mm-hmm. If they want to be spread out, that's great too.
Tell us about Vivaldi Four Seasons. This is another really familiar piece to return home to.
Yeah.
Iconic. Yeah.
Absolutely iconic. And that it'll feature Justin Bruns is our lead violinist on that program. He's the associate concertmaster of the Atlanta Symphony. And he's been with us for a few years. And it's a phenomenal piece, of course. It's four different concertos. And we utilize a lot of these themes in our children's music throughout the year when we present for the kids, so they recognize it. And it's just technically, it's a very flashy, brutal piece, but it's when it's going to be performed at the skill level that these guys produce, it's going to be a great program.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, a piece like that is one of those invitations into classical music. And I know this programming includes things like The Doors, Riders on the Storm, but there's also this sense that there are certain pieces that invite people to enjoy and appreciate classical music. What is it about something like Vivaldi's Four Seasons that does that for listeners? Why is it so prevalent?
Well, it's prevalent because it's a masterfully composed piece and organized, and it takes you through the different seasons of the year. You know, Vivaldi even has poetry that goes along with it. And what he's trying to do through music is to set a scene for you. So we all know what the middle of winter is like here. And you've got that icy sound, and the wind is blowing, and it's cold, and you hear it in the music. And the summertime, the summer storms, you hear it in the music, and the audience can relate to it. It's really special when a composer can bring to life his own experiences and share
and
that with the audience.
And that's also used in children's program. Tell me a little bit more about inviting kids into the experience of classical music or music played with a traditional classical music instrumentation.
Well, we do this through our musical story time. In fact, we just completed one this morning for 120 children over at the YMCA in downtown Rapid. Today's setting was the Gingerbread Man. Now, so my wife, Dawn Marie, is the artistic and education director, so she had found a way to start writing adaptations of different stories so that everyone knows the story of the Gingerbread Man. Well, this is a new version. Apparently, the Gingerbread Man was born in the Black Hills at a magical bakery. Who knew? And he runs into a tourist family from Florida, and they go on adventures. And the music that goes through, so then the storm comes up. And in this case, we use Rossini's Storm. But then he goes up to the bear country, and he goes through all the attractions and gets to play with the small animals, and they play the can-can. And then goes to Deadwood and comes across the bikers. Well, that's the Gingerbread Angels bike group. There you go. Sorry. And that's
Gingerbread Angels Motorcycle Club.
Yeah. Very tough group. It's a very tough group. They go great dipped
stand
in milk.
Stand back.
Yes. But we utilize these opportunities to introduce the kids to classical music. Yeah. And the kids love it.
All right, very quickly, in like 30 seconds, we've got the Age of Aquarius, July 23rd and 24th. Give us some highlights from that, Mike.
Okay, that program is all the composers on that program were born under the sign of Aquarius. Now, it's interesting, but it's all these composers, Mozart, Edward Lalo, Jerome Kern, and Franz Schubert. It was, instead of thinking of a certain time of year, it was regarding the heightened artistic output of that time.
Yeah. Are we heading into another heightened artistic output in a hopefully continuingly post-pandemic global
It sure feels
resurgence.
Like it.
Yeah.
It sure feels like it. Everyone's excited. Things are moving forward. Yeah. We're excited about this season and really hope that people would come out and enjoy it.
The 14th Chamber Music Festival of the Black Hills presents Friday and Saturday concerts over the next 3 weeks. It's at the Journey Museum Gallery in Rapid City, and each weekend features a different program, which we've highlighted for you today. Information on each show and information on tickets is available at cmfbh.org, and we'll put a link up on our website as well to point you in the right direction. Executive Director Michael Hill, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Laurie. It's great speaking with you as always.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Thank you to all our guests and to SDPB's Megan Feary and Ariel Zients for their help with today's production. On tomorrow's In the Moment, the Dakota Political Junkies are with us. We're going to talk about the history wars, critical race theory, and then also about the incoming event in Rapid City that celebrates freedom. All that and more. For Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, Josh Heyer, I'm Laurie Walsh. Thanks for listening.